in a tractate called Sanhedrin 43a from the Mishnah section of the Talmud is the very arrest notice of Jesus. It goes like this. Wanted, Yeshua HaNotzri. That is his name, by the way. So we know they're talking about our Jesus. He shall be stoned because he's practiced sorcery and lured Israel to apostasy. If anyone can say anything in his behalf, let him declare it to the great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem.
Folks, if you enjoy this broadcast, consider diving in a little deeper with our White Horse Inn study kits. These kits are perfect for small to medium-sized groups from 5 to 15 people, and they can also be used for family devotions or individual study. Choose from several subjects like how to read your Bible, do we all worship the same God, and the parables of Jesus. For a donation of $15, you'll receive download links to leader's guides, student guides, full-length audio, and short audio clips pertaining to each lesson. Just head to whitehorsein.org/study kits. That's whitehorsein.org/study kits.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Belief in a historical cross and resurrection is a non-negotiable, given that it's the center of our faith as Christians. Redemption isn't real if it's not historical, but how can we really know if the New Testament is historically reliable? Isn't it just maybe a matter of faith? Do any other ancient texts confirm the reports that we find in the New Testament documents? In order to discuss this, you have your usual cast of characters here, along with Craig Parton, who is sitting in for Ken Jones, and a special guest, Dr. Paul L. Meyer, the Russell H. Seibert Professor of Ancient History at Western Michigan University. He's also a historical novelist and serves as second vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a graduate of Harvard, Concordia Seminary St. Louis, and the universities of Heidelberg and Basel, where he studied at Basel with Karl Barth and Oskar Kuhlmann. Professor Meyer is also the son of Walter Meyer, the founder of the Lutheran Hour, so it's a real pleasure to have you on the White Horse Inn again.
Well, I'm delighted to be on, especially the fact that you pronounced every one of those names correctly. I think it's the first time in history everybody got it right.
Shocking. It must be the Prussian DNA on my mother's line
you did a beautiful job.
Thank you. Dr. Meyer, what do you say to the college student who's being told regularly by professors that though you can trust Herodotus and Thucydides as authentic historians, you can't trust the Bible in this way because it's actually a work of mythology?
Well, you know, what a wretched double standard we have in that respect. You know, they take the rules of literary criticism. That's fine. Apply it to the Bible also. But what they fail to realize is that there is a whole lot of collateral affirmation of the biblical claims in so many areas of the Old and New Testament on the outside. And I didn't know these existed years ago. When I was growing up, I thought that every last detail about the life and death of Jesus and all those who preceded him would be locked inside the black leather covers of the Bible. And I didn't realize that the outside secular sources, some of them anti-Christian even, do concede many of the things that are reported also inside the Bible in terms of some major personalities, some major events, episodes, and references. And so I was really thrilled that this was the case. Back in Sunday school days, I assumed it would have to be the case if these things really happened. If they really happened, these stupendous miracles and whatever else, there should have been some fallout in the secular materials from the ancient world. And so I kind of made it my life's hobby here to research these points of tangency between the sacred record in Scripture and the secular record outside. And I find that you can build bridges between the two all over the place.
How about in terms of the hostile witnesses? Obviously, those who claim to be eyewitnesses, on the Christian side of things, those who believed in Jesus' resurrection are affirming these events, but What have you found you've been able to get out of the hostile witnesses of early Jewish and Roman historians or political figures writing about those events?
Well, interesting question, because in many ways, I have a lot of fun with hostile witnesses. I almost prefer them to friendly ones because I look like a hawk at what they concede. And if it's concede something in favor of Christianity from a hostile source, then you know that's historical. Then the rubric of historical research cuts in that's called the criterion of embarrassment. I know it's a strange-sounding term, but it's one of the tightest proofs from the outside that you can use. For example, if you're arguing in a given direction, and in the direction of your argument, you have to concede something that opposes that argument of yours, but you have to concede it because everybody knows it's true, then 2,000 years later, you know it's true. It becomes self-authenticating. For instance, when the Roman historian Cornelius Tacitus doesn't like the Christians, he considers them so much sewage and whatever else.
And when is he writing?
He's writing about 64 A.D., when Nero had been on the throne about 10 years and was planning to go to Egypt, but he had to change his plans because of the great fire of Rome.
So he's saying this.
And careful historian that he is, Tacitus goes on to explain how Nero's throne was tottering, and in order to save himself, he blames this wretched group of misanthropes called Christians who believed in a Christ, and suddenly the pernicious movement was almost scratched off the face of the earth until suddenly it gained new vigor and suddenly flowed even as far away as Rome, that common cesspool. And then he goes on to describe who the Christians, how they were persecuted by the Roman state, and so on. So this is a terribly important passage that should give the lie to any of these latter-day pathetic people who, via the internet and whatever else, try to claim that there never was a historical Jesus of Nazareth. Anybody who makes that claim today is simply advertising his own ignorance. But notice that it talks about this faith suddenly gaining new vigor after Jesus was crucified by one of our governors, Pontius Pilate, Tacitus admits. This is either Easter and or Pentecost or both of them, because it did grow explosively after that. That's just one little example.
Doesn't that kind of get at Hume's argument against Christianity, namely that it's like a fish story? Something small starts in one area, and then as it expands and grows out over time, further away it becomes a big story, when in fact already you have Tacitus, a Roman senator and historian, saying that Jesus Christ was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and even there in Judea, this great horrible mess broke out and has now infected Rome.
Oh, absolutely. And there's no question about the historicity of these people or the historicity of the narrative. I know of few trials in history that have been better authenticated than this one from the ancient world. You have not only the judge Pontius Pilate showing up in all four Gospels, and also in Tacitus, and also in Josephus, of course, the Jewish historian of the first century. But we have archaeological evidence for Pilate. His name shows up in a great cornerstone of a building he erected at the Emperor Tiberius, discovered at Caesarea on the sea. We have, of course, more information on the chief prosecutor on Good Friday, Joseph Caiaphas. We know a lot more about him, not only from the four Gospels, but Josephus gives us tremendous detail about his family and his background. And we have his bones, by the way. A thrilling discovery was made in November of 1990. It wasn't announced till 92, but the bones of Joseph Caiaphas, the chief prosecutor on Good Friday, came to light accidentally south of the temple area in the old city of Jerusalem. His ossuary was discovered with his name on it. And this is a thrilling thing, because it's the first time that we've had the actual bones of a biblical personality showing up.
Amazing.
Accidentally, biblical bones might have been discovered before that. I think we could have discovered the right leg of King David, I guess, but there's no tag attached to it. But in this case, his name twice in Aramaic. And so few people know that. I mean, I can be talking to a pastoral conference, 300 pastors, and I'll say, who knows the name of the owner of the first biblical bones ever discovered? And about three hands will show up, 1%. I mean, what does it take to get the word out? I think it's a thrilling discovery.
That is really remarkable. And it's not coming from the Vatican.
That's right. Exactly.
Professor Myers, you've edited a book on the essential writings of Josephus. Can you give our listeners a little background as to who he was and some of the controversy that surrounds his famous passage about Jesus?
Indeed. Josephus is really a gift of God to the church, even though he was a Jew who never converted to Christianity. He's a tremendously gifted Jewish historian born in the city of Jerusalem 4 years after Jesus' crucifixion. So he has a box seat to the events of the later New Testament era. No fact escaped him. He had imperial patronage in which to write his famous History of the Jewish People. See, the poor gospel writers had only one scroll in which to communicate their good news. This is why the gospels are as short as they are. That's the size of one scroll. Whereas Josephus had imperial government help in producing his famous History of the Jews 28 times as long as one single gospel. So the detail that flows out of this person's pen is unbelievable. And what's so interesting is every place where Josephus does tangentially come into contact with some of the same people and places and events that are reported in the New Testament, the confirmation ratio is 100%. I mean, they say the same thing, sometimes Josephus giving us additional precious detail that's not in the Bible. For example, the execution of John, beheading of John the Baptist. The Gospels don't tell us, but Josephus does. Josephus tells us that the execution took place at Herod's summer place, just at the northeastern corner of the Dead Sea, called Machaerus. It's catty corner from Masada that everybody knows about in the southwestern corner. I think that's kind of a neat additional detail. And by the way, I always have fun when I talk about Josephus with my audiences, proving that every last Christian has used Josephus whether or not they know it. And here's how I prove it. I ask him to report the beheading of John the Baptist, and they talk about Herodias' daughter and her famous dance. And then I ask, what's the name of the daughter? And everybody answers, Salome, or Salome, pronounce it as you wish. And I thereby say, well, now you've all used Josephus. Why? Here's the shocker. Her name does not show up in the Gospels. All we have is daughter of Herodias. How do we know her name was Salome? Thank you, Josephus.
Interesting.
See how beautifully it corroborates the biblical record? Yeah. But here's another one. Who was the first bishop of the Christian church anywhere on earth? And don't answer Simon Peter, you'll be wrong. It was, of course, James the Just of Jerusalem, Jesus' half-brother. Okay, wouldn't you think the New Testament would tell us how he died? It does not. And guess who does? Josephus, Antiquities, Book 20, Section 200. Then James, the brother of Jesus who was called the Christ, was stoned to death by the Sanhedrin in the absence of the Roman governor, who hadn't gotten there yet, a guy named Albinus, and when he arrived, he was so ticked off at this kangaroo court decision to terminate Jesus' half-brother that he arranged to have the high priest canned out of office. A perfect parallel to Pontius Pilate on Good Friday trying to do the right thing, trying to let Jesus off. And all your critics come along and say, oh, no, the Christian church is whitewashed Pilate. The Romans were terrible people, and nobody would think of trying to protect an innocent man. Wrong. Here we have, in the writings of Josephus, a non-Christian, a total exoneration in many ways of Pilate's role because of what happened just 29 years later in terms of Jesus' half-brother. So that's why these witnesses outside the Bible are so very, very interesting and important.
Do you take the report in Josephus in his Antiquities as an accurate transmission of what he actually wrote?
Yeah, I didn't answer that part. I'm glad you reminded me of that. He does refer to Jesus now in two famous passages. The second passage I've just given you, the execution of his half-brother James. This one has never been denied or debated by scholars, and it was Josephus's authorship, no question about it. But earlier, two books earlier, in Antiquities, Book 18, section 63, we have Josephus referring to our Jesus. And it's the longest reference to Jesus in secular sources from the first century. Therefore, it's a terribly important passage. And we were told back in seminary days never to use it because it had been interpolated. An early Christian scribe, thinking to do God a favor, baptized the passage. And I agree, it had been interpolated. And you can just hear it for yourself. Now, this is written by a Jew who did not become a Christian. It goes like this. About this time, there was a man, if indeed one, we ought to call him only a man, you know, right there, who did many wonderful things among us. And when he was crucified, he rose again from the dead on the third day. He was the Messiah. And in other words, hello, this man must have been a Christian if he wrote those words. So I think there must have been some tampering with the text. Okay, wind up to 1955. I just graduated from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. And young pup of a grad student, I was so ticked off that this most important passage on Jesus had been screwed up that I wrote, took it upon myself to write the world's ranking authority on Josephus, a scholar in London, a Jewish scholar named Paul Winter. And I asked him two questions. Do you think Josephus ever referred to Jesus at all at that place? Because all the critics were saying, throw the whole passage out. And a second question to Dr. Winter. If you think that Josephus did mention Jesus, how do you think the passage originally read? Use your critical tools. And I got a letter back from him. It was, I think, only about 3 weeks later, which wasn't bad in those days, no internet. And in answer to the first question, Dr. Winter said, yes, he was quite sure that Josephus did refer to Jesus at this point. The prose is similar to Josephus elsewhere. Then using his good critical tools, he teased out a translation that I thought convinced me this is what Josephus did write. And the tragedy is Dr. Winter died before he ever learned how near he had come to the truth, because in 1971, a Hebrew University in Jerusalem scholar named Dr. Shlomo Pines discovered a manuscript of Josephus that was not interpolated at that point. And it reads almost word for word like what Paul Winter predicted it would read if we ever got an original version of what Josephus wrote.
Wow.
So that's a thrilling confirmation. And by the way, I think it's a very fair outside view of who Jesus was. But Josephus is honest enough to say this. About this time, there was a wise man called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. Many people among the nations of the Gentiles and the Jews followed him. When he was crucified by the governor Pontius Pilate and died, those who would become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he came back to life 3 days later. Accordingly, he could possibly have been the Messiah, concerning whom the prophets have reported wonders, and the tribe of the Christians so named after him has not disappeared to the present day. Now, that objectifies it. You notice? It doesn't. The passage is cut out there. He was the Messiah. The passage is also reporting the resurrection. They reported. The Sunday school version says he rose from the dead. They reported that he appeared to them on the third day, restored to life. You see the difference there? And this is why it rings with authenticity, and that passage can now be used again, even though it had been somewhat ruined earlier.
And what is the date that we're talking about here?
Antiquities were written by Josephus in Rome about the year 94 to 98,
okay.
Sometime in there. It's still in the first century.
So still in the first century, and everything that he says there, empty tomb, the resurrection is the answer to it. So even outside of 1 Corinthians 15 and a host of other passages, we have Josephus saying that the earliest Christians believed on the basis of the apostles reporting that Jesus had been raised on the third day.
Absolutely. This was not invented later on, like David Hume said, like a snowball getting bigger and bigger as it accumulates more snow going down the hill.
Wow, that is really remarkable. This entire year, we've been digging into the Gospel of John during our discussions on the White Horse Inn broadcasts and through the pages of Modern Reformation magazine. Together, we've journeyed through the life and work of Jesus. It's challenged and it's changed us. The truth of the gospel has replaced false ideas. We're liberated. We've focused on getting the gospel right, but what do we do now? Well, we get the gospel out. We have the great privilege of being involved in what God's doing here on earth as He extends His kingdom. Whether it's through a conversation with your neighbor or at the bedside of a friend, we're called to engage others with the message of hope that Christ offers. With that in mind, Core Christianity has a new Bible study based on our year-long study of the Gospel of John. We've created this resource to empower you to share the good news of Christ, our Lord, with your family, your friends, and neighbors. This new study is available to you for a gift of any amount. We have tremendous opportunities ahead of us, both here and abroad. We're ready to create more resources to help Christians know what they believe and why they believe it. The gifts we receive directly impact what we can accomplish. So head on over to whitehorsein.org/John today to receive your copy of our new Gospel of John Bible study. Or call us at 1-800-890-7556. That's whitehorsein.org/John. Or call us at 1-800-890-7556. Thank you for working alongside us to get the gospel right and get the gospel out. We really appreciate your support. Welcome back to the White Horse Inn as we're talking with Professor Paul Meyer about the historicity of the Christian faith. Writing around 95, Josephus recollects the period leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem and saying, "Now some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God and that very justly as a punishment of what he did against John, that was called the Baptist, for Herod slew him who was a good man and commanded the Jews to exercise virtue both as to righteousness toward one another and piety towards God and so to come to baptism. Accordingly, he was sent a prisoner out of Herod's suspicious temper to the castle and was there put to death." It's really remarkable how much it corroborates.
It just is. This is why when I discovered Josephus late in my seminary education, it just electrified me. I was just so thrilled to see these corroborations on the outside. And not only did it support the biblical version, but it added beautiful, fresh brush strokes, color, depth, dimension, more detail to some of the biblical events. And so naturally, everybody wants to know more about the people and events in the biblical times. And boy, Josephus is one big source for that.
Dr. Meyer, do we have significant sources from the rabbis of the first century as to what they thought of Jesus and how much?
Oh, you bet we do. You bet we do. And it's important to realize that there were probably a lot more references to Jesus, but they were cut out because of the anti-Semitism in the Middle Ages when the Jews were forced to live in ghettos, when there were pogroms. The Christians at that time didn't like any references to Jesus in their materials. And so they burned some of them. And so there were probably more references to Jesus in the rabbinical traditions than we have. But one terribly important one is the arrest notice for Jesus, which the Gospels don't have, but which rings with authenticity. I love this one. It comes from the Mishnah section of the Talmud, which is the earliest section, as you recall. And in a tractate called Sanhedrin 43a is the very arrest notice of Jesus. It goes like this. "Wanted, Yeshua HaNotzri." That is his name, by the way. His name was never Jesus. It was Joshua of Nazareth. It's a King James translators who turned that into Jesus because the Greeks couldn't write Yeshua. They wrote Jesus as close as they got. That's how we got to Jesus. But I've always told my people, my audience, that he's a very forgiving Lord. He'll understand if you call him Jesus. I mean, what I'm trying to say is if Jesus would have had a driver's license, on it would have been Yeshua HaNotzri. Joshua of Nazareth. That was his name given by Mary. Anyway, so we know they're talking about our Jesus. And here's the arrest notice. He shall be stoned because he's practiced sorcery and lured Israel to apostasy. If anyone can say anything in his behalf, let him declare it to the great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. It doesn't make any mistakes. It wasn't contrived. Future tense is used. They haven't arrested Jesus yet. If they'd have said he shall be crucified, I'd say throw it out. Not a chance that any Jew would have ever thought that Jesus would hang on a cross. If they were going to get Jesus, how would they have terminated him?
Stoning
to death. They've been trying to do that for 3 years anyway. And so it says, he shall be stoned. And then it says, because he's practiced sorcery. Now look how beautiful that reference is. That this is where the criterion of embarrassment cuts in. Now, sorcery and miracle are the same thing if you're not talking cause. If you're talking cause, a miracle is something extraordinary or supernatural with help from above. Sorcery is something extraordinary or supernatural with help from below. But here you have a hostile source, doesn't like Jesus. It would have been in their best interest to say nothing about him. Or if they were unethical, to lie about him, but they concede that he's doing something supernatural. Mm-hmm. And I think this is fascinating because it's almost a lead pipe cinch from a hostile source that something special was going along here anyway. That's what we call a criterion of embarrassment.
Are there also rabbinic sources that say in the Mishnah, for example, that Jesus was a bastard, he was born without a father, and is that part of the criterion of embarrassment?
Oh, yeah. They don't mention that in the arrest notice, but that is another section of the Talmud where that's mentioned, yes. The idea that Jesus was born sired by a Roman centurion named Panthera, which is a corruption of Parthenos, virgin, get it? And so they misunderstood that. So there are some nasty passages on Jesus, too, right?
But is that just by attributing to him having an illegitimate father, doesn't that, again, have a sort of, why did they feel like they had to come up with an explanation for his parentage when the...
Yeah, good point. Good point. Never thought of it that way, but that's true. The very fact that you have this kind of attempted explanation for something spectacular like a virgin birth, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Is it safe to say that from the Mishnah we get Jesus had a controversial paternity? He performed wonders. We're not going to say who from. The Christians and the Jews agreed that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate.
On the eve of the Passover.
On the eve of the Passover by the Romans, but through the instigation of the Sanhedrin, and that he died on the cross and was buried, and then there was a controversy about where he was 3 days later.
Exactly. Absolutely. That's most of that's in the Talmud, yes.
That's just staggering.
Remarkable. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's just typical of the outside. You know, in terms of the outside witnesses, I think there's only one case of where the secular evidence doesn't bear out the sacred evidence. All the other points of tangency are beautifully affirmative and correlate perfectly. And I think, you know, that track record is pretty impressive.
Well, it sure does narrow everything down to, okay, then how was the tomb emptied, not whether the tomb was empty?
That's right. We can prove historically that that tomb was empty on the third day. As a matter of fact, in my book, In the Fullness of Time, the Easter section of that, I first brought out that argument in 1973, and I challenged any scholar anywhere in the world to oppose my argumentation. It took two whole chapters to demonstrate it, but I laid down the fact of from ancient history that the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, in which Jesus was buried on Friday, was in fact empty on Sunday morning. Now, again, I quickly point out that an empty tomb doesn't prove a resurrection. But if you reverse that statement, you can't have a resurrection, at least a decent one, without the tomb being empty. We don't want to get Greek here, you know, Jesus died, but his spirit lives on,
right.
The spirit of Plato or something like that. And I have yet to have one ranking scholar anywhere controvert my evidence. As a matter of fact, it worked quite oppositely. A Jewish scholar in Tel Aviv picked up my argument and was so impressed with it that he used it himself, with my permission, in his own book on Jesus.
Wow.
The historical Jesus, he called it, and he asked my permission, and I, of course, gave it. I couldn't believe it, because he was admitting the tomb had to be empty on Sunday.
Wow.
And I asked him, by the way, what his explanation for the empty tomb was, and he answered, well, he thought that Jesus never died.
Oh,
the old swoon argument, remember
yeah.
that one?
Yeah,
you know?
Wow.
In the cool of the tomb, he revived and came out under his own power. And then, of course, I said, oh, Dr. Kornfeld, I explained to him the batting average for death after crucifixion is about 1,000. You know, the Romans just never let people feign death. That's the reason for that executioner's gesture at Golgotha, the javelin that went into Jesus' heart. I'll give you an example. In these wonderful human demolition derbies, I call them, gladiatorial combat, when the arena is just full of dead bodies, between every act, if we dare call it that, the Romans had a figure dressed like Pluto, with a red-hot wand, wander among the bodies, and he would pierce each body. And if there was any flinch, whatever, a pike went through the heart. So the Romans are deadly serious about executions. They have to work. You know, and so we're not going to solve it that way. So Dr. Kornfeld, by the way, said, I understand that, Dr. Meyer. Well, I will present my version of it, and then I will also let you provide your rejoinder. I didn't believe he would do it, but he was as good as his word. I couldn't believe it. You know, here he presents. We both agree in the empty tomb, and then he tries this threadbare explanation, but he gave me the last word. I couldn't believe it.
What about the Romans? If the Jews unwittingly give credibility to the Christian claims, what about the Romans?
Well, you have... Again, you got to remember, throughout the first century and beginning of the second, there's a hated sect. It's illegal after Nero. You know, the persecutions don't quit till Constantine, for goodness sake, finally takes the heat off. And this may be one of the reasons why there are not more references to Jesus. We do have, besides Tacitus, by the way, we do have Suetonius, we have Pliny, and others such who also refer to Jesus.
Could you refer to, give us some examples from those writers?
Yeah,
and
who are they? Suetonius is a second-century author writing about the first century, and he gives us this neat book called The Lives of the 12 Caesars. In the reign of Claudius, section 35, he says there was a big controversy in the Jewish quarter in Rome, region 14, it was across the Tiber, over the claims of Christ. In other words, there was a dispute in the synagogue, continuing in Rome. Then Pliny the Younger, who is governor of Bithynia in Asia Minor. That's the Asiatic side of Istanbul today, on the other side of the Bosporus. That's Bithynia. And he's writing the Emperor Trajan. And he says, what do I do about these Christians? They get up early Sunday morning and they sing hymns to Christ as if he were a god. They're against the law, aren't they? And fortunately, we have Trajan's answer. And he says, yes, dear Pliny, they're against the law, but don't go hunting them out, and don't take any unsigned accusations, which is pretty fascinating. It shows there the Roman Empire is moderating. The persecutions were not one long knockdown, drag-out fight against the Christians. They were on again, off again, as I show in my book on Eusebius.
Is it significant that Pliny, as the governor of Bithynia, a politician, not exactly a philosopher of religion or historian of religion, is commenting on Christians praying to Jesus as a god, and am I recalling correctly, he even mentions that they eat a meal together over which they believe he presides?
Something like that, yeah, yeah. There's more detail. In fact, we have the long letter. It's about 2 or 3 pages worth. A fascinating letter, testifying, by the way, to the explosive growth of Christianity. He says the temples are being deserted. People aren't coming to buy sacrificial meat anymore because of these Christians. But I think I can turn it around, dear Emperor. Mm-hmm. Pliny's trying to, you know, cover his tracks and say, I think something can be done and we can turn these people to a better view. Indeed, there is a very, very powerful testimony here.
Dr. Meyer, Larry Hurtado at the University of Edinburgh has argued that there just isn't any precedent in either Judaism or any Roman religions for what we have here in the early worship of the Christian community. Do you agree with that? This is so unique, you can't do what the history of religion school used to do, show how what we know as Christianity evolved out of something very different and became a lot more formalized around the cult of Jesus as the Christ.
Well, what you have are these, what I call them, they're parallelomaniacs. You have the forever these people trying to say that all religions borrow from one another ever since Fraser's Golden Bough was published. And so often today you find the claim made that Christianity learned everything it taught from either the Dead Sea Scrolls people, oh, that's now canceled, nobody believes that, or from the those following the religion of Mithra, Mithraism, and so forth. And what you find every time, and they will tell you about wise men visiting the birth of Mithra and so on into the night, and all they are attempts of retrojecting Christianity back to the origins of these other religions. It doesn't work. I think Hurtado's right.
Why does any of this matter? I mean, as long as Jesus remains for us a symbol of loving your neighbor and of the connectedness of all of life and all human beings and the importance of love and compassion, who cares about all of these historical details?
Well, that's I'm glad you bring that up, because very often in my seminars here, I'll be talking blue in the face, talking about these beautiful proofs we have outside the Bible, and then some dear old lady in the back of the room will stand up and say, Dr. Meyer, isn't the Bible enough? Do we need anything else? And I immediately have to go, yeah, the Bible's enough. We don't need anything else. All I'm doing here primarily is trying to clear the trash away from the temple door so people can go in unimpeded. There is so much trash being thrown up today, so much smoke screen being thrown up in terms of the entrance to the church by jealous other religionists, by competitors, by cultists, by would-be super scholars on Jesus who want to see their name in print. People like Bart Ehrman, you know, saying that we're misquoting Jesus and whatever else. They always get a lot of press. That's one way to bestsellerdom. Ask Dan Brown how that works. Simply tell about six lies per page about Jesus and the church that he founded. That'll get the hackles of the church up, and you've got controversy. That's a mother's milk of sales. So you have all these people throwing up all these smoke screens that are false, and I'm just patiently trying to clean up after them.
Wow.
And so, in behalf of this dear Christian woman, you don't need more than the Bible. But I say, isn't it fun to get this additional data?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Don't inquiring minds want to know? I did.
Absolutely.
Dr. Meyer, this is Rod. Yours is not the typical mind.
Hi, Rod.
How you doing?
Folks, you've been listening to Dr. Paul Meyer, the Russell H. Seibert Professor of Ancient History at Western Michigan University. We always appreciate it when you take time out of your schedule to be with us, and thanks for walking us through these important texts.
Oh, listen, glad to connect this time.
And also, we ought to mention to people, you really ought to go to, in the fullness of time, and read Professor Meyer's account of the empty tomb, the argument there for the empty tomb.
And I heartily recommend Professor Meyer's version of Josephus, and especially Eusebius' Ecclesiastical History. You did a great translation there, Dr. Meyer. That's a great rendition of that.
Thank you so much. You might mention the website in which these are described, Paul Meyer, M-A-I-E-R, one word, .com.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us on the White Horse Inn.
Right. Bye-bye.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, check out the support page of our website, whitehorseinn.org. If you are new to the White Horse Inn, be sure to click on the first-time visitors link from our homepage, where you can order our free intro kit.
By signing up for this kit, we'll send you a complimentary copy of the current issue of our magazine, Modern Reformation, along with extended length editions of The White Horse Inn on CD, completely free of charge. All you have to do is request our intro kit. Simply look for the first-time visitors link on our homepage at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.